You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, The Devil's Backbone and the Baroque Horror of Guillermo del Toro, featuring fascists, bugs, gears, clocks, vampires, mad scientists, gill men, con men, freaks, geeks, pinheads, weirdos, fawns, princesses, princes, Hellboy, and empathy for all of the above. Martin.
Yes.
It's not a ghost story. It's a story with ghosts in it.
Yes, yes, I know you're hungry. Ah, and here comes dinner.
Feed my
Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining us as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, we're doing Guillermo del Toro movies, which, like a lot of things we've already said on this podcast, I can't believe it took us this long to get here. Because I feel like he's, I mean, for better or worse, one of the defining voices of this modern era of horror.
Yes, yeah, 100%.
Was he always one of your guys?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so I saw Mimic opening weekend on a first date with Deidre Lane, eighth grade. Big crush on her. And
it always like confounds me when you can remember the names.
Oh yeah,
Deidre.
And
where art thee now?
Who knows? No, she was super cool. But we went and saw this.
Call us if you hear this, Deidre.
And I remember like liking it. And then it was really Devil's Backbone that I was working at a grocery store. I was working at the grocery store, and they had a video counter.
Sure.
And they randomly had a VHS of like that with dubbing of Devil's Backbone. And I watched it at my parents' cabin. I said, oh, my God, this is really great. And then he did Blade 2, and it was kind of after that I was in.
Blade 2 was the one for me,
yeah,
personally.
And then I think Hellboy like really solidified it, where I was like, because even when he did Blade 2, I was like, oh, I really like Devil's Backbone, but I wasn't like a Del Toro, like a fan yet, in a way, of him. But in hindsight, it all is so, talk about a guy with a very consistent eye and a consistent vision and a consistent world that he builds since Kronos.
It's fascinating to think about his filmography and career at this point, because he also was one of those guys that was like the earliest flashpoints or people that like the Ain't It Cool News kind of audience championed.
Yes.
Because there's obviously the infamous Harry Knowles,
oh, Jesus
Blade
Christ.
2 review that equates Blade 2 to Cunnilingus. You can look it up if you've never read it. It's disgusting.
It's but like, no joke revolting.
Like
read.
One of the worst things that's ever been put to print. But like, I think it is fascinating in hindsight that he, kind of like the MCU, is one of those moments where we can sit there and go, the geeks won. Like one of their guys. And like Rian Johnson, I think, possibly to a lesser degree as he gets more and more kind of esoteric and weird with the Knives Out movies, despite working with Netflix and everything. Like he made a Star Wars movie, and he's kind of a one of us filmmaker. But Guillermo always struck me as like one of the ultimate one of us filmmakers of that group. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Well, I think him and we just talked about him, Sam Raimi.
Yeah.
You know, is the definition of, you talk about Sam Raimi does Spider-Man, and
right,
everyone is like very happy because,
which is right around the same time that they both kind of hit the apex of their career.
Well, they're 2 months apart. I mean, March 22nd, that's a weird thing to remember, was when they released Blade, and then May 2nd or 3rd was Spider-Man. So like in the end of my senior year of high school. But I would agree, and I think that internet film culture grew, he was so visible. Like, there were so many interviews, there were so many cool things of him talking about what he loves. And like you said, he is this guy who has, you know, I guess he sold a lot of it off, but his house in LA that basically is just a, you know, a cabinet of curiosities of right. like all this horror memorabilia and occult stuff and like grimoires, and like he really lives.
I mean, he even has the whole Netflix series called Cabinet of Curiosities. It's basically named after it.
Right. And our buddy David Pryor did one of the great episode. But I think it was that. And then it was also he kind of came at that perfect time of monsters being the hero. That's always been his thing, or monsters, like you said, having empathy for them. But like, that, you know, early 2000s into now, you have so many of these horror films that are also where it's like, oh, what if it's a vampire romance? What if it's this?
Sure.
I feel like he's the one who was already doing that since Kronos.
I think it also helped that he was like, I'm going to do the art movie version of this, but he did it in a foreign language. It was kind of at the same time as like, it's easy, right? I mean, always, frankly, but like, especially right now, to make fun of like Harry Knowles and like it kind of outcast him and everything. But like, it was at the time when Harry Knowles was really championing people like Guillermo del Toro. And I mean, again, a filmmaker that's now in the prestige kind of arena of filmmaking is Park Chan-wook.
Yes.
Is that he, I remember reading Harry Knowles's review of Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, like I think on a top 10 of the year list where he put it as number one for whatever year that movie came out, and being like, I've never fucking heard of this South Korean revenge thriller. And it made me seek that out and then seek out Old Boy and find a bootleg of these movies and everything. And like Guillermo del Toro was kind of the same way, to where it was like, you know, we make fun of Harry Knowles, but at this time, these guys were making these genre stories in foreign languages kind of outside of the United States. And like, for a lot of like film nerds and people, especially who were getting into the earliest kind of circles of online film culture, like that was your gateway drug to like foreign genre cinema.
Yeah. And like Bong Joon-ho as well, and how he went from, you know, stuff like The Host, which is also has a lot of, you know,
Memories thematic, of Murder and all that too.
Up to now being an Oscar winner, they both are, you know.
Exactly. Like, these guys were the earliest kind of flashpoints for that corner of genre cinema on the internet.
Well, it's also interesting, though, I think that he's one of the filmmakers who survived the Weinsteins. Because famously,
especially with Mimic.
Well, yeah, so Mimic was, you know, a big movie, and from all stories told, they did that era, their normal fuckery of like re-edits and reshoots, and there's a director's cut, there's their cut.
Well, and also the inclusion of Mira Sorvino in that movie, who came out as one of Harvey Weinstein's accusers.
Yes, there's just a lot in there. And from what I've heard, because he said the only way he survived was similar to what Rodriguez does. He would go home and edit every night.
Yeah.
And so he was like, they basically couldn't take it away from me because, I think this is what he said, they couldn't take it completely away from me because I basically gave them an edit.
Right.
Like, I finished it. It was like, it's here.
And he was also sort of like, Soderbergh is the other one too, is that he edits almost to keep himself not only productive, but sane, to get an idea.
Yeah.
In and take the wine scenes out of the equation, but the insanity of like the creative process is like putting his fingers on that kind of daily shoot, or the footage that was coming back to him, and just being like, this is how I make sense of it.
Yeah, and like in real time, saying like, this is the story I'm telling. And I rewatched Mimic with Val, and like, I hadn't seen it since the theater. I watched the director's cuts. I honestly don't remember how much has changed. But I will say it's a lot better than I remember. I mean, it is a fine, in the end, a pretty generic monster movie.
It's a good Dimension Films release.
And that's exactly it. And the three
stars, that's it.
Yeah, and the look of it looks like that late 90s. Like, it's the greens of, like, The Matrix.
Right.
And, like, that rainy, consistently rainy city, the kind of look of Seven, you know. It fits in with that.
But it does lay the groundwork for a lot of what his movies would kind of be coming forward, which is a lot of those like bugs icky, gross, slimy kind of creature feature things. But the thing is, I think what separates Mimic and Kronos, his vampire movie, from a lot of the stuff that kind of came after it, is that there's the monsters there are truly that. They're monsters. They kill humans.
Right.
They're horrible. They're in the most traditional sense,
yeah,
the villains of the horror movie.
We created them, but they still need to be stopped.
Exactly. Yeah. Where he would develop an empathy for these creatures as his filmography goes on.
Yeah, and like I rewatched Kronos, which I hadn't seen in a while, and it's not my favorite. It's definitely like a freshman feature. But there's just so much stuff that just gets drawn into the rest of his films. And another guy to obviously clearly compare him to would be like a Tim Burton. They're kind of sure. the fairy tale. His is a lot more Mexican, you know, and it's a lot more romantic in that sense.
Also, he's just the artier Tim Burton.
Yeah.
To where it's so much of it is production design and cinematography and everything, where like Burton is making very Baroque studio pictures, but they're poppier than Del Toro's are.
Agreed. But the main comparison, the main similarity would be that you look at a frame from either of their films, you're like, that's a Tim Burton movie.
Right.
Because their production design, and they're both artists. I mean, I have one of the Del Toro notebook. It was this like collection of images from, you know, he famously carries around these notebooks all the time and is constantly drawing. He's right. always drawing. And so like I think he had the idea for the Reapers in Blade 2, and like, oh, what if this like they're this, you know, giant almost alien thing comes out of their throat and their jaw breaks open. That was just him. He's a doodler, you know, but it also has, you know, it's trees mixed with gears. It's like nature. It's, you know, elves and bugs, and it almost looks like a mad, like also Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing.
And I mean, like his movies are rooted, especially as we go forward with like Pan's Labyrinth, Devil's Backbone to a lesser degree, but like even something like Blade 2 and I mean Pinocchio, obviously, but right. like they're fairy tales.
Yeah.
You know, Frankenstein, even his latest, like kind of, and the movie that he's building towards, like his entire career, and that has been his passion project the entire time. Like he even interprets Frankenstein almost as like a fairy tale.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a very like somber beauty to all his films. I mean, even that's what I think is so interesting about him is that, you know, even when he does like, I almost consider something like Pacific Rim as one for them. While it is very Del Toro, there is still these moments of like pathos, you know, of just pathos of just like very romantic. He really goes for it.
Sure.
In the same way as Blade 2, I mean, the ending of him, you know, holding Nyssa, the vampire princess, as she is destroyed by the sun, and this, you know, lilting music rising. And so he's always finding an opportunity for that. It's always a Del Toro movie.
Well, it's the romanticism of it all.
Exactly.
Too,
yeah.
To where like Blade 2, like you would never, after seeing Stephen Norrington's Blade, be like, man, you know what would be great here? If fucking Blade had a love interest.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's what Del Toro looks at that character as. It's like, what if we gave him like a tragic love story that will never work out in the end? And I mean, it's the same as like the end of Pan's Labyrinth. As much as it is about a little girl, it is about like a little girl who will never experience love or romance or yeah. anything like that too. And like, his Frankenstein, the newest one, is like, it very much is like, here's a man trying to navigate, who's been born against his will and trying to navigate existence, and who will never get to experience love. And that's the one thing that he wants. He wants a companion from his creator. And I mean, Crimson Peak is kind of the ultimate, right? Is that he takes a ghost story, and it's what we even use as the quote for our like intro to this episode, is that it's like it's a ghost, it's not a ghost story, but it's a story with ghosts in it, is that he tricks you, makes you think that this is going to be a haunted house movie, but it's really just a gothic romance that happens to be populated by the undead. And yep. It's like he loves this like kind of ethereal yearning that populates in this melancholy that really permeates like the majority of his storytelling.
Yeah, 100%. And it goes back, I mean, you have that in Cronus in particular, and then, I mean, all his Spanish language stuff. I mean, and my favorite, you know, Devil's Backbone, which, you know, interestingly, he was supposed to direct Blade One.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he had finished Mimic, and like, it still did fine, and like, he's in the mix now of Hollywood. And Ari Arad and the early Marvel guys with New Line said, "We want you." And he said, I had to make a decision. He goes, he had such a horrible time making Mimic. He said, I do want to keep making Hollywood movies, but if I don't go make like one for me, I may get swallowed up by the machine and I'll never come back again. Which is really cool, because it sets up his entire career, you know, in that he kind of, again, one for them, but also, I didn't say one for them, one for him, because it is very much his personal smaller stuff, and then these big, more like huge blockbusters. You look at, you know, Devil's Backbone, and you look at Blade 2, which come out a year apart, and they couldn't be more different in terms of scale, in terms of tone.
They're both Pan's Labyrinth, kind of his biggest, at least prestige breakout. Is right after Blade 2, too.
It's right after Hellboy.
Okay.
Yeah, so he does, it goes back and forth. Yeah, so he does Devil's Backbone, Blade 2, Hellboy, and then Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Devil's Backbone very much is that quote from Crimson Peak of, it's, you know, it's not a ghost story, it's a story with ghosts in it, because it is straight up this, like, story about children at this orphanage during the Spanish Civil War, and just the terror of fascism is just like out. They're in the middle of this field in this old, I forget what it was before. It was like a church or something. It was like a weird building, or like a monastery that's now being used. I remember the first time I saw it, it was my earliest experience of what you said of, I thought this was a horror movie, and it was very much advertised as a horror movie, like from the guy who made Mimic, you know, and you're like, oh man. And it's not really scary. I don't think it's trying to be. It's spooky, but I love, he's so amazing at working with kid actors too. You see that also with Pan's Labyrinth. And I think he is such a big kid that he very much, he's like Miyazaki in that way, as he knows how to write and to direct children, and you get these amazing, like, you have the sense of wonder, but also the terror of being a child, specifically an orphan, as you kind of, you know, have in Devil's Backbone. And an early, also, the beginning of the themes exploring of wonder and creativity in a time of fascism. That runs through a lot of his stuff. You have that definitely with Pan's Labyrinth of, her uncle is literally, you know, a fascist officer. Her stepdad is a fascist officer.
Pinocchio's a fascist.
Pinocchio's definitely. No, but I mean, you definitely have it with Shape of Water, of like finding love and whimsy inside of, you have this very fascist character in Michael Shannon.
Well, he's the American version of everything that he would kind of create in his Mexican film.
100%.
Is that
the villain in particular, the human
one.
Yeah.
To where, and Shannon, man, he eats that role up completely.
Yeah.
In Shape of Water. So let's start to get something out of the way. You and I come at this director from very different angles, is that I don't love Devil's Backbone.
Right.
I admire it.
Yeah.
And I've tried many times to get in with that movie. I like all the way back to like seeing it on probably DVD for the first time.
Yeah.
But it's just, I appreciate, like, my favorite movies of his are kind of the ones that you are almost at the bottom of your list. Like, my favorite movie, like Guillermo del Toro movie of all time, is Nightmare Alley.
Right.
I think Nightmare Alley is his crowning achievement. It's a movie I can't get enough of. Like, every time I watch it, I think it gets better. And then I watch Shape of Water right after. And Shape of Water is probably my second favorite of his.
Yeah.
And you prefer his Spanish language stuff.
Yeah. I think there's a... I think Shape of Water is a very well-made movie. I liked Nightmare Alley so much more this time watching it. I actually think it's great. I did not like it the first time we watched it together.
It's a masterpiece. Like, no. I'm going out and saying it, like, straight up. I think it's one of the defining movies of this era, especially if you look at it from any kind of political angle.
Oh,
God.
I think
it's one of the true Trump-era movies, especially coming out of the first Trump term, is that it's a movie literally about con men. Everybody's lying. Everybody's trying to get, up, like, one up on one another. And at the end,
it's just the grift.
It gets to the dark heart of like humanity, in that everything you do is for a buck, and it doesn't matter if it's not for money.
Well, and that's what's so interesting, though, is that again, the monsters of this film, the freaks, are all most good, right? They are all lovable. The real monster of this film is the human, is the human spirit, right? And
well, it's like Bradley Cooper's biggest sin that he commits isn't taking people for money. It's breaking Rooney Mara's heart.
Yep.
You know,
well, because she's leaving. The princess of the carnival.
And she represents a purity that he leaves behind. And also just rejecting, it's like that, the, you know, one of the great performances in Nightmare Alley for me is David Strathairn.
Oh, he's as his fucking mentor, amazing. Yeah.
And he's the one who you know, teaches Bradley Cooper how to do his routine and everything.
Mentalism.
But the entire time, he tells him, and there's that great moment where he goes, don't do the spook show. And it's about not resurrecting the dead, not connecting someone to this con that you're trying to run that gives them like a almost spiritual connection.
Yeah.
That will damage them.
It's one step too far.
And Rooney Mara, you know, is the kind of light at the end of that tunnel of being like, you can keep doing this. You can keep like basically fleecing these rubes and making a living. But even she's kind of like, what you're doing is a violation of what even like the carnival rules are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And man, Richard Jenkins, you want to talk about like a 1-2 punch of like performances inside of like Del Toro movies. Like he really found one of his great collaborators in Shape of Water and Nightmare Alley, in that Jenkins gives two of his best performances of his career right behind Step Brothers.
Well, no, I would agree. Cause in that, again, so totally different, where he's the most lovable best friend, uncle character you could ever ask for in Shape of Water.
Well, and he's an outsider.
Yeah.
He's one of Del Toro's like trademark outsiders in Shape of Water. He's a gay man existing in the early 60s he's the narrator of the movie. And it's like, I think it's also like, where I differ from you is I think if you take Shape of Water and Nightmare Alley together, there's some of his best political statements, because again, it's about these people who exist, who are outsiders and exist in a time when people want to destroy them.
Yeah.
And Richard Jenkins is a guy who like, he literally illustrates like, you know, we lived in the end of a great, the reign of a great prince, which he's obviously talking about JFK.
Yeah.
And like, here comes the Cold War and everything that comes after like JFK's assassination and the persecution of black people and gay people and everything. And like, Jenkins represents that as like this closeted gay man who can only find communion and kinship with this mute woman. And like, it becomes like his Amelie, in a way, of like these people who find a joy and wonder and whimsy together. Then I get that if you're allergic to that type of thing, and especially that tone, Shape of Water is not going to work for you.
Well, and I'm not allergic to that often. And Amelie is one of my favorite movies. I mean, and I kept watching. I said, wow, this is so Jean-Pierre Jeunet. But it also reminds me, I mean, these two filmmakers who love their Ron Perlman, who also is a walking monster. Even when he has this like this look to him. And I think about, you know, City of Lost Children could have been made by Del Toro. Like that you know. Also, Terry Gilliam's in that space of this kind of fantastical. Also, City of Lost Children is like Devil's Backbone, about children. Also, this young girl is very similar to the girl in Pan's Labyrinth.
And Mad Scientist.
No, I like Shape of Water better this time, too. And I think it's a great film. It's just not – what I like about his stuff is I think part of it is I like his the Spanish, the Mexican and Spanish settings. I like those worlds. And I like, one of my favorite writers is Carlos Ruiz Zafón, and he writes these amazing Gothic mysteries that mostly take place in like Barcelona at a similar time period as Devil's Backbone. And they're these like Borges, you know, Borges like labyrinthine mysteries that go through the city and their secret societies. And so it's like, I just like to soak in that part of his filmography.
Sure.
I also think that like Pan's Labyrinth is one of the most beautiful films like ever made. And what I like about it is that while it has, there's a lot of whimsy to that film as well. There's also the danger of even the, you know, the Fawn and these monsters she's facing. She's going off on this kind of adventure, which is still terribly dangerous. And for me, Shape of Water, it gets, for I just as a viewer, it gets lost in that whimsy. There's some parts with the Desplat score, and I love Desplat, where it's just, like the dance number I really fucking hate.
I think it's tremendous.
And I find, and I love Sally Hawkins. I mean, bring her back, it's one of my favorite movies of the fucking year, and she's so good in Shape of Water. When she's like dancing and walking down the hallway, it just makes me kind of gag. I'm sorry, like, it just doesn't work for me, man. And it's a me thing. It really, really is. I don't think it's a poorly made movie, but it doesn't speak to me.
I'll never forget when we were working on the issue of the BMD magazine. I guess that was 2018 when Shape of Water came out.
2017, 2018. Yeah. Yeah.
And me and Scott Wampler got to see it at like 10 in the morning at a private screening. And we were both really into it. And I guess it's just a memory that I cling to, especially now that he's gone, is that we both sat there when that dance number came up on the big screen in that empty theater. We were just kind of like, that like, you'd never really seen anything like that before. And the fact that, you know, and part of it was the kinship of like Wampler being so into Creature from the Black Lagoon,
which is my favorite Universal monster too.
And like him having that kind of connection to that and just seeing that interpretation of it, of like, nobody ever thought the creature could dance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, and watching it go to, from like this, you, when we were texting back and forth while we were revisiting all these films, you described Shape of Water as looking almost like a Pixar movie. And I don't think that that's entirely wrong, especially because of how,
and I was complimenting that, to be clear. I think it is so crisp.
Well, and I think, it's not just that. It's how much he commits to color schemes inside of his movies. It's like the same way that he commits to the color red inside of Crimson Peak.
Right.
That's how he commits to the color green inside of Shape of Water, is that, but when it desaturates in that moment and becomes a dance number in black and white, is that you're just watching a guy create a literal stage for these monsters to play on that you never considered before.
Yeah.
And it's messy and it's weird. And it's obviously from like one person's imagination. But like, to me, that's what movies are supposed to be, is that it just takes off into another stratosphere. And for me, like, as much as I like Michael Shannon's performance in that and everything, like, those are the parts of Shape of Water that feel kind of rote, because it's almost like you've seen Del Toro do the fascist before.
Right.
You know? And like, where like the scene where Sally Hawkins floods the bathroom and they just float together and have that moment where she's naked with him. Like, you've never seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's just, it's him truly embracing the monsters and giving you his interpretation of those monsters in that moment in a way that like is unique to cinema itself.
Yeah, no, and I won't disagree with any of that. You know, I think it is a purely, it's a taste thing, right? And it's like, I love Del Toro. He's one of my favorite filmmakers. He, like, Devil's Backbone is in my top 10 favorite movies of all time. Like, and I will see everything he does till you know, day one of us passes away. And I, but yeah, and I like a lot of Shape of Water. It's just like, And I know exactly, like you said, what he's going for. And he goes for it. That's the thing, is he's not, it's a very brave.
He's not afraid.
It's a very brave thing to do. But
that
also.
Think about the fact that Shape of Water won the Best Picture Oscar.
Right. No.
Oscar. Which that's insane.
No, it's crazy. And it's like.
But it's a movie where a lady fucks a fish man.
But again, where I think we're saying the same thing is, to be brave is, as a filmmaker, is to be not afraid of criticism and say, I'm going for it. Not everyone is going to love what I'm doing here. Right. And so that's what I'm saying, is that, like, I have no problem with the fact that he did it. It makes sense in that world. It just isn't for me.
It's just not for you.
You know what I mean?
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you think one of the worst things that ever happened to Del Toro was critical acceptance?
Yeah.
It's one of the things that I've thought about, especially in the wake of this very divisive release of Frankenstein, which, let's be real, Frankenstein, I think, is very much lesser Del Toro.
Yes.
I think it's the movie he's always wanted to make, but he's done the Frankenstein story
yep.
way better using other characters. Like Blade 2, we texted back and forth while we're watching all these movies, is that, like, Blade 2 is almost a better Frankenstein story than his actual Frankenstein.
Yeah.
You know, I would argue that Hellboy uses parts of the Frankenstein, especially the father son stuff.
Yeah.
With Professor Broom.
He's so and good. Hellboy. John Hurt.
Yeah. John Hurt's incredible in it.
Yeah.
But all the father son stuff between him and Hellboy in that is 1,000 times better than anything in his actual Frankenstein adaptation. But I also think that there's a tinge, and I'm not accusing you of this, mind you, with your Shape of Water criticisms, as I do think that once he won Best Picture, is that there was he suddenly was no longer one of us, but he was one of them.
Yeah. No, I mean, to your original start of the podcast, you're talking about, he's one of the first, like you said, one of us, and he's, you know, the early days of film criticism of, wow, here's a film horror nerd who's making stuff that he loves the same stuff we love. You know, he loves horror, he loves gothic stuff, he loves comic books.
I also hate to put it this way to bring up any kind of physical appearance or stuff too, but like, he's a fat dude.
Yeah.
Like, he looks like, if you looked at him, or fucking Harry Knowles, or Quint, you know, Eric Vespi, or even Wampler, or any of these guys, like, he's a fat guy. Like, it was just kind of like, he looks like one of the nerds, too. Even more than Rian Johnson. Like, Rian Johnson's kind of nerdy, but he's still kind of a handsome little dorky dude.
Right.
But, like, Del Toro's, like, this very big man who looks like a guy who, like, if he wasn't making these movies, he would be blogging about them from his basement.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I think you can probably go ahead and accuse me of that, and you're right. I think I do fall into that category, that subconsciously, it is, you know, it's the generic, you know, the band got big, right?
And it's the Radiohead theory.
Yeah, and, but at the same time, it's funny, one of the things I experienced with rewatching Nightmare Alley, which literally just jumped like 100 points in my estimation when I saw it again. I think the first time we watched it was like your back room.
It was us.
It was us.
We watched it on a screener.
And I think, but Carrie's like, we were kind of talking. Like, I think it was like,
we watched it late at night.
We were a little distracted. And
because I remember I got it and I texted you and you were like, I'll be there in 10 minutes.
No, because you were living at Lunar and I was over at my old apartment and I was like, literally like, I'm getting in the car right fucking now. Because you're like, hey, just got Nightmare Alley. I'm like, oh my God. And I was so excited. And I don't think I got it the first time. And I think with second viewing of how clearly from the beginning, Bradley Cooper is a heel. From the very, very beginning, is he's working people. He's watching, he's stealing ideas. And it had a very similar experience. It's a weird comparison of when I first saw Mindhunters. First episode, I go, God, I hate Jonathan Groff so much. He's so annoying. My mom goes, he's supposed to be. I'm like, oh, like, it's like, he is this Boy Scout who's supposed to be like, he's so up his own ass about what he's doing. I said, oh,
yeah.
I just thought he was annoying. Like, versus, no, that's the point, you know? And the same thing with Bradley Cooper. I said, especially for a guy who likes to play these like likable dudes, he's really good as a shithead, like as a charming, handsome guy who just under the current is stealing from you from your back pocket. You know, he's amazing in this movie. Probably his best performance. And I know you don't love Silver Linings Playbook. I do, but I think those two are my favorites of his.
I mean, I really like Stars Born too.
He's great. He's great in that.
That's another one. Jackson Maine's a really, really terrific performance from him. I also think he's just a really good director. Like, I know Maestro isn't anybody's favorite, we'll say, but I still think it's a very interesting movie that kind of gets buried by the Netflix algorithm, we'll say.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but, I mean, Frankenstein is the one, while we're on the topic of Netflix, that, for me, is the massive disappointment. I think I feel that way tenfold as to how you felt about maybe Shape of Water or Nightmare Alley, is that we went and saw Frankenstein in the theater. It was me and you and my girlfriend Savannah, and we sat there, and I kind of felt the air going out of the room.
Yeah, for everyone.
And it's because there's stuff about it that I really like, but like, it's so engineered for Netflix. And then watching all of these movies after the fact, like revisiting all of them, it's incredible how a man with such a robust visual palette has been like smoothed, like almost, it's almost like if you took Del Toro and put like HDR smoothing everything.
Yes.
Good. And it's just crazy. And the CGI is terrible. And for a guy who also touts like practical effects and anti-AI, like that's his big talking point on this PR campaign, is like, fuck AI and all this stuff.
I'll never use it. Yeah.
You watch it and you're like, right, but you still made a passion project for Netflix that seems, even through the structure itself with the prelude and the bifurcated narrative with the chapter heads, almost made to be streamed at home so that people can take pee breaks and maybe even watch it in the background.
Yep. I think I would agree. I was really disappointed in this, and I was looking forward to, I think, more than you were.
100%.
And I love the book. I'm a big fan, obviously. Just, I mean, I have two Frankenstein toys right there. I love him as a universal monster, one of my favorites, along with the Gill Man. And maybe that's kind of my problem with Shape of Water as well, is that, like, I've wanted a Creature in the Black Lagoon story for so fucking long. A remake, it's been just bouncing around Hollywood since the 90s, I think, or even the 80s. I think John Carpenter even talked about possibly doing it back in the day, and there was a maquette, all this shit. And, like, so for me, I'm like, cool, I'm getting it, but I'm getting, like, a romance. And it's like, if someone wants that, it's great. But for me, it was like, almost was like a tease to me. But with Frankenstein, I had the same problem with it that I had with Nosferatu, in that however you add a, you know, have the vampire hang dong, or you make it weird, or you make it beautiful and you make it like historically accurate, it's still just the story. It's still just a story that we all know. And that was my problem with Frankenstein, because Nosferatu got boring for me, where I was like, well, I know where this is headed. There's no twist. So I don't need that. But Frankenstein felt, for everyone talking about, he found his own message. And I was like, where?
Well, and I hate to bring it up again, because we kind of did on the last episode with Night of the Demons, but like, after seeing Bram Stoker's Dracula on the big screen, as you sit there and you watch Nosferatu or even Frankenstein, and you sit there and you go, like, what was the point here? Like, why would you make a quite literal adaptation of these classic novels if you weren't going to bring any kind of distinct visual flair to it? Now, Nosferatu, I think, is a bigger, it commits a bigger crime in this arena. I find that movie incredible. Like, it looks great if you put it on in a bar on silent in the background, which I have done. But, like, if you actually try to watch it with the sound on and everything, it's just excruciatingly boring.
Yeah.
But, like,
and Lily Rose Depp sucks in it. I think she's really fucking bad.
How fucking touted her performance was, it's almost, it's painful.
No, I hate all that, like, bullshit of, like, it's basically a possession movie in that part. And they're like, no, she really goes for it. I'm like, all right.
Well, and it's also one of those things where, you know, it's a bunch of fucking film nerds who just are, and journalists who are, quote unquote journalists, we should say, who are regurgitating all these PR points of like, she's really going for like Isabella Gianni.
I was just going to say, yeah.
And it's just, it's, this is the shit that the people who are representing the film who are telling you, and you watch it and you don't have any original thought of your own. So you just fucking vomit this bullshit back onto print so that you can get quoted on a poster. Like, eat shit, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
But like Frankenstein at the same time, like, at least it's an original take on the character.
Right.
But like, I just got in after we saw this version, I bought the Arrow video release of Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein. And frankly,
I like it better.
I prefer it.
Yep. Like, well, it's like Bram Stoker's.
Is it a better movie? No, but it at least is doing like a distinct thing with it, to where it's the Merchant Ivory operatic version of Frankenstein. Does it all work? Absolutely not. Is it bonkers? Totally. Should Kenneth Branagh be shirtless as much as he is for the movie? No, probably not. But like, at least he's going for it. We're like, this version of Frankenstein feels like half like Del Toro's version and half sort of like, what did Netflix want me to do to engineer to the algorithm and the person who's going to watch this at home on like a Sunday afternoon while they're folding laundry? Well,
yes. And think about his early stuff. And he's working with his cinematographer, Guillermo Navarro, who's one of the best
tremendous.
To ever fucking do it, period. Yeah. Devil's Backbone, whatever you think of it, is a gorgeous movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the night stuff, holy shit. That movie is so beautiful. Even if you're not a fan of the story, holy shit. And you put that, or you put the night scenes of Mimic up against the stuff in fucking Frankenstein.
Well, dude,
what the fuck are we doing?
Watch even fucking, like, that was the other thing I was thinking about is that, like, I don't love Crimson Peak, but watch fucking Crimson Peak.
Which is also quite digital, but yeah.
Right, but even opposed to, like, Frankenstein, like, looks tremendous on that Arrow Blu-ray. I mean, Shape of Water is one of the more gorgeous movies of the last, like,
yes,
10, 15 years. Like, it's just...
And Nightmare Alley's incredible. Fucking gorgeous.
Nightmare Alley's an amazing-looking movie.
Yeah.
What happened?
No.
Like,
it's insane.
It feels motion smooth to fit, you know, what we know to be, like, a quote-unquote, like, Netflix original.
Yeah. Well, the opening scene, like... It's just these big wide shot of the icebreaker ship, and the, you know, I'm like, cool, and you get some cool action, like him getting shot. I'm like, this is bad fucking ass, but I couldn't get over how bad it looked. And then we got to talk about, I think Oscar Isaac fucking sucks.
He's horrible.
Movie.
Well, okay, so let's play fuck, marry, kill. In terms of, like, who's worse in this? Oscar Isaac, Christoph Waltz, or Mia Goth?
Christoph Waltz is the worst.
He's the worst, by far. And he's also, like, the obvious Guillermo del Toro character. And is, like, a war profiteer who finances Frankenstein's
Who has
creation,
syphilis.
Who has syphilis and wants his brain to be transplanted into the monster. And also provides the mad scientist with the bodies from the war. Like... Do we need this? Like, fuck off, man.
No, he sucks. And then I would say Oscar Isaac, and then Mia Goth is not very good either, but I think
So we're fucking Mia Goth?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Or are we marrying her? Or can we just say both?
We'll just say, like, I'm just saying 1 to 3, you know. And it's funny, I really like Oscar Isaac usually.
I don't.
And it's funny, so I love, and I know you're not a big fan, I love Llewyn Davis.
I was going to say, I'm going to throw this out there. Oscar Isaac stinks. He's very handsome, but, like, he's incredibly vapid.
Dude, how bad is he in the Star Wars movies?
Yeah.
Like, really, really bad.
He's not a good actor.
Yeah.
Like, he looks like Al Pacino. He tricked everybody into thinking he's Al Pacino. Like, A Most Violent Year is one of the biggest offenders.
Yeah.
That movie sucks. And, like, everybody tried to compare it to a Sidney Lumet movie, and I wanted to fire it into the fucking sun.
Also, J.C. Chandor can eat a dick. Like,
yeah,
it's not,
fuck you,
it's
dude.
It's not good shit. But... the one thing I think he is really good in, I really like him in Show Me a Hero, the David Simon.
It's fine.
I think he's very good in that. All that aside, watching this movie, you're watching it.
He stinks in this.
He's really bad because I think it's a poorly written in the script too, because they very clearly from the beginning are like, they're not even high. This is our villain of this version. Like this is not a likable Victor Frankenstein. And they're really leaning in on the empathy of toward the monster.
There's a very thin line between this Victor Frankenstein and Michael Shannon's FBI fascist or CIA fascist in Shape of Water is that it's all about giving you an antagonist who tortures the monster.
Yep. Yeah. You know, 100%. And it's like, for me, the movie really picks up when we get to the monster story.
Yeah.
Because the first part, it's like, again, talk about by the numbers, like however cool, there's some cool production design, like the.
Until you get to the CGI deer.
That's bad.
Man, and the CGI wolves. What are we doing? Like, Netflix has unlimited resources. Why does this movie look like shit?
Yeah. No, it's, and this movie really, I'm reading a lot about it. And all these people were like, masterpiece, Oscar nominee. I'm like, do I watch the same fucking movie?
The thing is, the movie's not terrible.
It's not.
There's stuff about it. It's like 3 stars, pretty good.
Yeah.
But there's stuff about it that's just holding it back. Like, all the stuff we're bringing up is that it's almost like, what? Like, I don't understand if you're such a great artist. And, like, and also, like, again, they're on the PR campaign being like, well, we didn't want to use AI or CGI, so we built the whole fucking ship for like the prelude and all the stuff in the Antarctic, like kind of bookends of when they're on there and both the monster and Victor Frankenstein are telling their tales, and they're like, the ship is a character. And I'm like, are you sure? Like, why did you spend all that money and make it look like asshole by fucking shooting on, like, I guess a Canon XL1? Like, this sucks, dude. Like, and
what's that fetishized practical shit?
Yeah.
Where you're like, well, we did it for real. I'm like, why?
It's like you fetishized that stuff, but you didn't actually put the work into making the rest of it look good. And here's my other question for you. I get that Frankenstein is his passion project for like his whole life. Why, for the love of fucking Christ, did he not get Netflix to finance At the Mountains of Madness?
Yep.
Like, he was trying to make this with Tom Cruise for years.
And James Cameron producing.
I mean, I get it. Apparently, the legend goes that Frank Darabont's script for Frankenstein that he wrote for the eventual Kenneth Branagh adaptation, like, Del Toro read that when he was younger, and that was one of the big, like, inspirations that made him want to make a Frankenstein, like, movie itself. But, like, I get it, dude. But like, we already got that. Like, we don't have an the Mountains of Madness like adaptation. Like, you have the biggest financier outside of Apple, like, saying, here's all the money that you can have to finance any project you want. Why not go back to the Lovecraft thing?
Yep.
And that was the other thing that I kept thinking while watching this movie, is that it's like, I'm kind of glad that he didn't, so that didn't look like shit and make me want to kill myself the entire time. But, like, dude, what are we doing here? Like, we have a million Frankenstein adaptations that are better than this.
Yeah, that I think that's the crux of the issue, right? Is that I don't need or want another one, you know?
No, not at all.
And as much as I like the monster, and to your earlier point, too, about he's been doing Frankenstein stories throughout his entire career, and I mean, there's even elements in Kronos. While it's a vampire film, you have, you know, the man, Ron Perlman's uncle, the villain, who is this, like, he's using science to keep himself alive. It's a vampire thing, but it has this mad scientist Frankenstein vibe to it, right? Victor Frankenstein.
Well, and Professor Broom
in
Hellboy is, like, the good version of that, too.
Right, and you... What I've always loved about Del Toro is it is just this mix of a lot of awesome stuff that makes him so unique. That soup or that stew of like all the things he likes thrown in. So you get it all there. Like, you get the romantic, you get the, you know, just the comic book world, the vampire world, monsters, goo, slime, fairy tale. And it's like, that's Del Toro. And with Frankenstein, I feel like a lot of that falls away because he's going to the original text of this thing that's been running throughout. And now he's like, well, I have to actually do the thing now without being able to cover it too much with my own interest. However you cut the movie, it is just the Frankenstein story. Like, it just
is. And a very literal one of that.
Yeah, which I think just takes its power away.
Which is, like, just a massive bummer. You would think that a guy with such a robust imagination would be able to attack this from a different angle.
Well, and in the early scene where you have a very action-heavy opening scene of you meet the monster right away and he's just fucking yeeting all these guys with shitty CG.
Which feels like the most cynical part of the movie.
Well, and what
it's almost like him being like, okay, Crimson Peak didn't really work with audiences, like box office wise. It almost feels like that's like a studio note to where it's like, okay, what if your Frankenstein movie is essentially a melodrama about existence, but with Frankenstein at the center, you know, but could you give us like Frankenstein, like throwing a bunch of soldiers into the sun at the beginning and like fucking pushing the ship over and shit. Like it just doesn't, that feels like a studio note to me. It's a big action set piece that the rest of the movie does not have.
Well, I would agree. It's crazy though, is that one of Del Toro's gifts is he's really good at action.
Like, no, he really is. Yes.
Cause like whatever you think of Pacific Rim, he is like, there's a weight to these kaijus. There's a weight, like it's not Transformers. Like there's a real, like he knows it's basically Evangelion brought to life and it looks great. And
why he shot it all at the dark in the bottom of the ocean is another question.
But right.
Yeah,
it's murky. But I really like Pacific Rim and the same too. Blade 2, the action is insanely good.
Yeah. My God. The action in Blade 2, even with the CGI stunt doubles.
Yeah, I mean, like, the fight with Nomak, that final fight is, like, he shoots. He's like Sam Raimi in that he does not give over the action direction to, like, a stunt coordinator completely. No. or a visual effects supervisor. It is, like, amazingly, his shot selection is really great in that final scene in Blade 2. And
one, it also is, like, him very much, like, you bring up Cameron producing at the Mountains of Madness, like Blade 2 is his Aliens. Like, it's like he's like, okay, in the first one, it's like one vampire hunter going after vampires. What if we had a whole squad of motherfuckers going after these guys?
Yeah, with fucking Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
You know,
the blood pack is so awesome.
Oh, yeah, Donnie Yen and fucking there. Like, it come rules, on. Yeah. Dude. And like,
it actually bests the club sequence from the first movie.
No.
What?
No, nothing. Really? Will ever. The opening scene?
Yeah.
No.
No, I think that whole showdown with the Reapers.
Oh, it's great. But yeah. No. Okay. I think that opening scene is...
Agree to disagree.
No, I will not agree. I will agree to no such thing. It is... No, but like, he is so gifted at doing set pieces that part of me also thinks like, did he want to show off his act? Like, this is the one point to do an action scene. I would agree it probably is a studio note. But I would also agree. I mean, like, I remember there was a Vanity Fair article interview with him from 2010. And it was like one of those like 30 page, like in depth, like they spent a month with him or something. Like he was
just hanging out.
I forget who was prepping, but I had this horrible job after grad school. And I got an office once somebody quit, and I would just like read shit on my computer all day because it was just like I had nothing to do. And I remember that came out, and I read the whole thing, and it was cool. But Del Toro's, he's always working on like 8 projects at once. At least he's not in pre-production, but he has like a team of like maquette workers and concept artists where it's always like when this film gets off the ground, we're already gonna have the stuff ready to go. And like I remember, there's pictures of. This is 2010. He had his version of Frankenstein's monster, you know, of like, oh, and he was like he's really particular. I want the nose to be more broken or like show the bone and stuff like that. But he also had all the shit for Mountains of Madness. Cause that was in pre-production for real.
Oh yeah.
And it was going to be Ron Perlman and Tom Cruise as the two leads. As
you can still find all of the concept.
Yeah, for the Shoggoth and everything. Yeah. And he was like,
God, could you imagine that movie, dude?
Well, that's the thing too. Is like you and I both like Lovecraft, and like that runs throughout all his shit. I mean, like Hellboy's Lovecraft. I mean, like.
Yeah, take all the comic book stuff away. It's literally about a guy trying to keep the old ones from invading Earth.
And Mike Mignola loves Lovecraft as well. Yeah. So it's like they're both just like completely in that world. Also great action in that movie and in Golden Army.
Oh, my God. I mean, Golden Army is better than the first Hellboy.
100%.
Yeah, like, well, I love it so
that's
much.
That's almost his Batman Returns where he gets to go full Del Toro.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Where he goes all the way in.
The angel with the wings with all the eyes on it is like one of his greatest creature designs at the end.
In fucking sane, man.
I love the elf
culture stuff is so cool.
But it's also like the Blade too, the original Blade
for
him.
To, yeah.
You know, to where it's like he's just, like you said, allowed to go. I mean, my comparison, I mean, Batman Returns is probably the better of the two, but mine is the Halloween 2 to Rob Zombie's Halloween.
Yeah, no.
Is that it's the movie that you can tell he just wanted to make.
Or Halloween Ends to Halloween. Like, it's, we're finally in, we got to the sequel here. Let me do what I really wanted to do in the first place.
You want to get to questions?
Yes, sir.
All right. Questions about Guillermo del Toro's The Devil's Backbone and the rest of his filmography. Martin, let's just do this. Top three GDT movies, go.
Number three, I am going to do Pan's Labyrinth.
Okay.
I mean, it's masterful, like that whole fairy tale. It feels like one of his just the most del Toro movies. Like if someone's like, I've never heard of this guy, what's the first one to watch? I would probably recommend this.
That's a good pick.
I just think
it's also the most accessible.
Yeah. And then number two, I would do Hellboy 2, Golden Army, just for an amazing banger action. Tied with Blade 2, just like I have to put an action.
His like
in there.
Studio kind of action comic book properties.
Yeah. And as much as I love Pacific Rim, like I think he's still got some cool. That one's a little flatter and straight.
It just doesn't all work.
It doesn't. And also, Charlie Hunnam's not a great actor either. Like, I think he's pretty flat.
You know what's crazy, though, is I think he's actually perfect as the love interest turned Sherlock Holmes investigator in Crimson Peak.
Agreed, yeah.
Who's obsessed with Arthur Conan Doyle stories. Like, I think he's really good in that movie. I don't think he's a great actor either, but right. I think he works for that.
I think he's a weird American accent, too. Like, I like him a lot in, like, the Guy Ritchie stuff where he has the thicker. Like, I like him in The Gentlemen a lot.
Were you not a Sons of Anarchy fan?
No.
I watched all the seasons. See, that's my biggest, I guess, like, closeted sin or whatever is that all the douche bro series I watched all the way through and kind of liked like Sons of Anarchy. And
I like Entourage. Yeah,
that's you were texting me about the studio the other day and you're like, oh, this is like a less douchey Entourage. And I didn't text you back, but I was literally taking a piss at the bar and I read it and I like whispered to myself. I was like, I kind of like Entourage.
No, I do too. Like I say it to like guard myself from, like, you know.
Well, it's also easy to forget that like, when it first came out, the first two seasons of Entourage, like people really like held up as like a true representation of how trying to break into Hollywood was.
Yeah, and it was just good HBO. Like it was like
in that classic era of HBO.
Yeah, and you have like James Cameron shows up as himself. I think it's
Aquaman.
Aquaman, a bigger weekend than Spider-Man. And then number one's Devil's Backbone, as I've been saying. So those are my three. How about you?
Golden Army is three for me, two Shape of Water, one's Nightmare Alley.
Yeah.
I think Nightmare Alley is his defining masterpiece. Shape of Water is what all the romanticism and kind of melancholy that he's been chasing after that kind of runs. It's almost like he harnessed the thing that's like the undercurrent of the majority of his filmography and made it the showcase of it. And Golden Army is literally the same exact reasoning that you have, is that it's just he's unleashed on a studio level, making a story about a character that he obviously adores with an actor that he might adore even more than the character.
Yeah. And, they work so well together.
And all the casting, like we haven't even gotten into his creative partnership with Doug Jones.
Yeah.
You know, especially with Shape of Water as the Gill Man. Like he's one of the great creature feature actors of all time. Like it's just, he has these relationships with these even outsider performers inside of his films that represent almost the thematic core of what he's always chasing after.
And a really cool little tidbit too that I learned was that in the first Hellboy, you have Doug Jones playing Abe Sapien, but the voice is David Hyde Pierce.
Yes.
And in part two, it's all Doug Jones. He does the voice as well, which is so cool, where it's like he's very loyal to his people.
Right.
You know, where it's like, why would we just have him do it?
And also Selma Blair.
Yes.
Is incredible in both the Hellboy movies.
Yeah, like, and Ron Perlman is just like such a heart to all his movies too. Like he's the big brute with the heart of gold. You know, he does that Nightmare Alley as well.
Like he's and Kronos. Like
yeah,
he's really terrific.
He's great in Kronos. he's doing that shit eating grin he did so well, and you could see that like Del Toro's like, that's my guy.
Yeah,
like
he finds this connection with these lumpy, weird, angular character actors that nobody else really does.
Yeah, it's amazing to compare like his relationship with Perlman compared to like Tim Burton with Johnny Depp. Like here's their models, but it's like that's their worldview,
right?
You know, through these two, like one's very beautiful and one is a pure, like quite classically unattractive man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Double feature.
That's a tough one.
With Devil's Backbone? You want me to go first?
Well, the easy one would be The Orphanage, which he also...
God damn it, you stole mine!
Which he also... He produced, which is an amazing movie. Also a very low-key... It's barely a horror movie. It's more of a mystery.
The Reflecting Skin would be another good one if you've ever seen that with Viggo Mortensen.
Yep.
I mean, a movie that neither... I think neither one of us loved what we actually saw at the Exhumed 24-Hour Fest last year. Jack B. Nimble, I think, would play pretty well.
Weirdly, Paper House, honestly.
Paper House, which is bad, but, you know, it does play pretty well. Anything that kind of harnesses that modern fairy tale kind of ethos.
Do you know what I also do? And I was saying earlier, I would pair it with a Miyazaki film like Spirited Away.
That's a good one.
Again, great at writing kids. That's a very similar story. And Spirited Away actually pairs very well with like Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
You know, or even his later stuff like Wind Rises, which is less fantastical, but about.
But still about the rise of fascism, violence and fascism and everything.
And the Darkness and Man.
Exactly.
Even Boy and the Heron's about that as well.
Yeah,
so.
Terrific movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, I love him so much.
I mean, Porco Rosso kind of feels like a Guillermo del Toro movie.
Well, the humor is so... You could see, like, Ron Perlman playing Porco Rosso.
I'd rather be a pig than a fascist.
Oh, it's so great, dude. That movie fucking rules. Good action, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, really great movie. Remake, redo. Can you do this?
No. No. I think with Del Toro, he is one of those guys where
he's singular.
I don't ever want to see a version unless he's doing it. If he's expanding on it, like imagine him doing a longer 6-8 piece, you know, if he wants to do it with Netflix, Spanish Civil War kind of slow burn mystery in the world of like of Devil's Backbone. You know, and there are like, you know, tangents they could really take in that world. It is very isolated, but you know,
I will bring up something. I haven't watched this yet, but it's next up on my queue in Netflix. And it did have me thinking about since we were watching Del Toro stuff in the meantime. One of my great discoveries for this year is 000. the Amazon streaming series from Stefano Salima about the drug trade. It's one of the things that's captivated me the most. Well, he has a new series on Netflix about the Monster of Florence. The serial killer.
For real?
In Italy. Yeah, it's like, I think, a 4 or 5 part miniseries.
Oh, fuck, dude.
But I was thinking about, yeah, I can't, me and Savannah are both going to watch that.
Like, I had no idea.
We have it queued up next. That's our next series we're going to watch.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about it in terms of, like, that would be a thing that I would watch Del Toro do, is that if he took, like, one of his concepts about, like, imagine an expansion on Devil's Backbone as like a mini series or something for Netflix, especially since he has a partnership with them now.
Yeah.
And with Cabinet of Curiosities, is something like that, is that if he took one of his worlds and explored it that way. But this is also my way of just telling you that, like, we should probably watch The Monster of Florence together.
Yeah.
Because, like, I can't wait. Oh, it almost looks like him doing Zodiac in Italy. Like, it's about the obsession and how, like, they could never catch this guy and everything. Like,
yeah, there was a Douglas Preston, who writes Lincoln Child. He wrote, like, The Relic and stuff.
He
wrote a book about Monster of Florence. Like,
well, it also shows up in Hannibal.
Yeah.
The sequel to Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
Because that's the killer that Hannibal Lecter models and kind of hides his crimes after, is the Monster of Florence.
Oh, fuck yeah.
But yeah, we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, Face Melter, Devil's Backbone?
No.
Nah, yeah, I would agree. It's too much of a slow burn, kind of esoteric.
But a lot of his stuff, you know, like, I showed Hunter, my buddy had never seen Blade 1 or Blade 2, and he's a Del Toro fan, too. I showed him Blade 1, he goes, that was great, and I show him Part 2, and he literally fell out of his fucking chair. Like, because it's just amazing. Like, so he has some.
Yeah.
You know?
It's in there. I mean, Blade 2 might be the only one.
Yeah,
because if we're talking about in pure face melt, the rest of them are too much mood pieces to be face melters.
Even Hellboy, it takes its time. Hellboy 1 would probably be close because it's a straight.
Like, I love Nightmare Alley, but I love Nightmare Alley because I basically exist inside of it for 2.5 hours, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, I love just sinking into the couch, getting kind of high, and just letting that movie surround me.
Oh, it was great watching on the TV, and I held the lights off, same thing. I was just like, oh, fuck, man.
It just looks incredible from that moment that he enters the carnival on. Jesus. Like, it just is mind-blowing. Well, Martin, this is great.
Indeed.
We don't really know what the next episode's going to be. If you're following us religiously, please know that secrethandshakecinema.com is back up.
We're back, baby.
We're back. We're going to have new writing every week for you to read. I'm doing a column myself called Headcanon. This week it was Lifeguard featuring the great Sam Elliott. Next week I know that we floated the idea of maybe doing an Osgood Perkins episode since Keeper's coming out.
Yeah.
And that's also kind of like Guillermo del Toro, a divisive filmmaker between me and Martin. But you'll have to stay tuned to see if that even comes to fruition, because we might just come up with some other shit that, you know, fascinates us more. So stay tuned.
See you then.
All right. Bye. And his son, the sea was rocking, over digging the sun.